Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Deeper Waters Podcast. I am Nick Peters, your host, and today we've got a special show lined up for you. My guest seems to be running behind. I'm trying to email, figure out what's going on and such, but as people who listen to this show know and who follow my blog regularly, I take Autism Awareness Month, which is April, very, very seriously. Why? Because my wife and I are both on the spectrum. Both of us are diagnosed with Asperger's, and so we're always very sympathetic to the cause. In fact, someone took us out to lunch yesterday, and we noticed that there's a flyer there for Autism Awareness Month, which we thank the manager very nicely for doing. And so, with Autism Awareness Month going on, I wanted to get a guest on here who could really relate to what goes on in the autism community. And he's running behind. I don't see him here yet, but when he gets here, my guest today will be Dr. Hugh Ross. Now, Dr. Ross is the president of and founder of the Reasons to Believe Ministry, which is a science and Christianity think tank, which means that, yeah, I'm getting into science a little bit, which is something I don't normally do, but I'm making an exception today. He's the author of numerous books, such as Matter of Days, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, Fingerprint of God, Creation and Time, several others. Lives in Southern California with his wife, Kathy, and their two sons. His academic credentials are right. He was the director of observations for Vancouver's Royal Astronomical Society at age 17. He was a recipient of the National Research Council of Canada Fellowship. He has a Bachelor's of Science in Physics from the University of British Columbia. And he has a Master's and a PhD in Astronomy from the University of Toronto. And he's done postdoctoral studies researching distant galaxies and quasars at Caltech. And as a lot of people don't know, Hugh Ross is also diagnosed with Asperger's. Now, I found this out in a very unusual way. My wife and I had heard that there were a lot of Aspies in the astronomy community. And so, my father-in-law, Mike Lacona, was at a meeting an Apologetics conference, and so he said, I'll ask Hugh Ross and see if he knows anyone who has Asperger's that he works with. So he asked, and Hugh Ross said, I have Asperger's. So that got things going, and when Hugh Ross was here in Knoxville in January, where I agreed to have, I asked him to come on, and he agreed, and we've been arranged for today to be the day, and he's still not here, so I guess I can talk a little bit about my experience with Asperger's until he gets here. As Vada, if you meet one person with autism, it said, you met one person with autism. And we are a very unique bunch. My wife and I both have a condition, but we're both extremely different. She got a more emotional side to it, and she tell you I totally got the intellectual side to it, which for me, that's a blessing. And we've often talked before about what would happen if a cure for Asperger's ever came out. If it did, she'd probably want to be one of the first people in line to get it, because for her, it's been a major hindrance, aside from the fact that it introduced her to me. On the other hand, for me, it's really been a blessing because it really allows my mind to grasp information in a different way and analyze it all and to multitask effectively, and it can lead to the comments about having an encyclopedic knowledge, although I can tend to be very laser-focused with my knowledge and sometimes miss out on other things because I'm so focused on one thing. And another difficulty, I should say, that comes with is it can be very difficult to function in a social situation, which is a way that Ari and I end up blessing one another, in that she can cover for me when I'm at a weakness, and I can cover for her when she's at weakness. We have to rely on each other for our own strengths and weaknesses. For instance, I mean, one of my big weaknesses comes with mirrors a lot of times. Oh, hold on, it looks like someone's here. I'm going to guess this is Dr. Ross. Dr. Ross, is this you?
Yes, it is.
Oh, good. Welcome to the show. I was talking about my own experience of Asperger's, but we'll save that for later on. But I've just also gone and told a little bit about your biography and such on here. But tell my audience a little bit, if they don't know you, about what's your story, about how you got to be where you are today, okay?
Well, I was born, raised, and educated in Canada. Grew up in Vancouver. And it was at age 7 that I got really interested in astronomy and began to study that very seriously. Knew from the age of 8 onwards that I would become an astrophysicist. And literally every year starting at age 8, I would do an in-depth study of a subdiscipline of astronomy. And, so it led me to eventually enroll at the University of British Columbia as a physics major, got a physics degree there. And then went on to the University of Toronto, thanks to a National Research Council of Canada fellowship. They paid for my education and wound up getting a PhD in astronomy, doing research on quasars with radio telescopes, and then went on to Caltech to do postdoctoral research on distant galaxies and quasars. So that's my professional background. Although what happened when I was at Caltech is I began attending a church because it was through my astronomy that I became persuaded that God exists, and actually wound up signing my name on the back of a Gideon Bible after 2 years of scrutinizing it, looking for scientific errors, couldn't find any, and realized that the Bible actually was accurately predicting future scientific discoveries. But it took me literally 8 years before I met Christians. I made the mistake of going to churches in Canada, churches where people didn't believe the Bible was the Word of God. And so after several futile attempts, gave up on trying to find Christians in churches. But in Caltech, I found many Christians in the astronomy research department. They helped me find a church. The church, after a few months, put me on their staff to train people how to use science as a tool to bring people to the Christian faith. And that organization, that particular church, helped me launch a science faith think tank called Reasons to Believe.
Okay. When I was talking with my wife earlier about this day, I was thinking this is going to be something that I think Dr. Ross would be amused to hear. My wife is actually a young earth creationist, and when we saw events going on, such as the Ken Ham Bill Nye debate, she was saying, why couldn't they get someone like Hugh Ross to do that debate instead? And when she's watching the History Channel and something comes on and you're speaking, with, oh, Nick, Hugh Ross is coming on. Come here and see this. So, yeah, you've got a fan who's actually a young earth creationist.
Wow. Well, I've got a few, so. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'll be doing a debate with a young earth creationist in Australia in a couple of weeks' time.
Hmm. And I was just thinking about the people in the astronomy community that my wife's very interested in the Japanese culture as well, and she's heard that there are quite a few Japanese astronomers who are strong evangelical Christians, and I think the number of Christian astronomers is really quite high, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's in astronomy where you get a direct witness of the past. You know, I tell my wife, for example, that because I'm an astronomer, I know nothing of the present, because all of our information comes from the past, thanks to the velocity of light. But the value in astronomy is you directly see the past, and you can literally watch what God has done throughout the entire history of the universe. So I don't think it's an accident that there are so many astronomers that do believe in God and an afterlife, and many of us go further than that and say, yes, it's the God of the Bible that has set all this up so we human beings can launch civilization, discover him, and form a relationship with him.
Now, we're going to be talking in the first hour about a couple of your books, and they're ones that you sent me for the purposes of this interview. First, just about why the universe is the way it is. Why did you write this book?
Well, I've written several books on astronomy and faith previous to Why the Universe is the Way It Is. And I wanted to write a book at a very lay level that basically explains to people why you have gravity, thermodynamics, electromagnetism, why the universe must be so big, so old, and how God has designed the universe from the very beginning with the problem of evil in mind. And so how the universe has been exquisitely designed to be a tool in God's hands to eliminate evil and suffering once and for all, and to bring redemption to the maximum number of human beings without disturbing their free will, in fact, in the process, enhancing their free will. And really trying to contrast for people the physics of this universe with the physics of the new creation, the creation that God will build once evil is gone and forever and gone permanently removed. So getting people excited about what they can look forward to in the new creation.
And one aspect of that that I think would be interesting to talk about is we recently here were watching the Aliens Week on, I think it's the Science Channel. And one question that comes up regularly when aliens are talking about, and I think you're skeptical of them based on Lights from the Sky and Little Green Men, is where the universe is so big, why would it be that only one planet in this whole universe would have life?
Well, that's something I addressed in Why the Universe is the Way It Is, that you cannot have a planet like Earth unless you have a universe of 50 billion trillion stars, where that 50 billion trillion represents just 1% of all the stuff of the universe. Make the universe ever so slightly smaller, there is no possibility for life. Make it ever so slightly bigger, likewise, there's no possibility for life. It all has to be there to get this one pale blue dot in which we live. And as of this morning, there have been 1,779 planets discovered outside of the solar system. And I remember back in 1995 when they found the first of these extrasolar planets, the presumption was they would look just like the planets in our solar system. But up to date, we have yet to find a single planet that looks anything like any of the planets in our solar system. And in the process, we've discovered that all eight planets in our solar system play a crucial role in making advanced life possible here on planet Earth. So the universe has got to be as big as it is, but also we see it has to be exquisitely designed in order to have one planet in the entire universe with the capacity to support advanced life.
Could you give some examples or reasons why that is the case?
Yeah, I could. In fact, I'm writing a new book on that right now, just about how the first billion years of the history of the solar system must be exquisitely fine-tuned in order for us to have a long history of life where advanced life is able to flourish at the end of that window of time. And one of the things we notice is that there is an incredibly narrow habitable zone. Now, if you read the newspapers, they talk about the liquid water habitable zone. And by adjusting the conditions of the star and the atmosphere of the planet, they can make that zone quite wide. But the truth is you need a certain flux of ultraviolet radiation. So there's an ultraviolet habitable zone. There's a photosynthetic habitable zone. If you want more than just chemoautotroph bacteria, you want photosynthesis so you can get advanced animals, then you've got a much narrower constraint. And there's even things like the wind that comes out of the star that must be fine-tuned. And then there's the tides. I mean, tidal forces can eliminate the possibility of getting a rapid rotation rate or getting a tilt of the rotation axis that wouldn't be close to zero. And the bottom line is there's multiple habitable zones, and every one of them has got to be there for advanced flight to be possible. And the overlap area is extremely narrow, so narrow that even though the universe has 50 billion trillion stars, we're quite confident we're living on the one planet on which advanced life is possible. Now, I do admit that the window is much broader if you're talking simple bacterial life forms. But if you want things like plants and animals, and especially human beings, then, yeah, we're living in the one spot. And it's not just the one spot where advanced life is possible. It's also the only spot where it's possible to do deep sky observations and literally discover the radiation of the cosmic creation event and recognize there must be a God beyond space and time that created everything. So we see design not just for the benefit of the existence of advanced life, but for the possibility of that advanced life actually measuring the entire universe and discovering the one that's responsible for the universe that we observe.
So when you talk about advanced life, what you mean is that if we find, for instance, that there's life, say, on a bacterial nature on Mars or on the ocean under Europa or on one of Saturn's moons, then that's not really what you're talking about. That kind of life could show up very well, couldn't it?
Well, it could. In fact, I would argue that it must. At least the remains of bacterial life will be found in every solar system body, simply because planet Earth is so prolific with bacterial life that every time a meteor strikes the Earth of sufficient force, that causes Earth's soil to be scattered throughout the solar system. In fact, I've argued that if we want to see what the first life forms on planet Earth were like, we're not going to be able to do that on planet Earth. The geology of Earth has destroyed the fossils of Earth's first life, but we should be able to find the fossils of Earth's first life in pristine form on both Mars and the Moon. And the Moon has got a much greater supply than Mars. So I've actually been advocating that we need to go back to the Moon and find the Earth's soil that's been transported to the Moon and realize in every ton of Earth's soil there's going to be about 10 to the 17 bacteria. And we already recognize that most of that Earth's soil arrived on the Moon, at least the soil that came from the time of the origin of Earth's life, on low-velocity collision events. So I think we can go to the Moon, find the fossils of Earth's first life, and see who got it right. Because atheists, Christians, deists, theistic evolutionists, they all have different explanations or models for what that first life should look like. We can go to the Moon and see who got it right.
Well, we're going to take a break here a little bit early before I ask my next question. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Hugh Ross, president and founder of Reasons to Believe. We'll be back after this break.
Can't get enough of your favorite rock radio shows? Well, now you can download episodes for free. Check out the rock radio program archive at cyiworldwide.com.
And I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast. We're back with Dr. Hugh Ross. And we're talking first off about the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, a little bit. Now, what I can hear some people saying, though, is that all this, though, this time, this space, all this just for life on one planet, doesn't it seem like kind of a waste? It's God's not making the best use of his resources there, is he?
Well, I think he is, in the sense that given the end goal, human beings with the capacity to discover the Creator, with his amazing curiosity and ability to launch civilization, given the very high value and the very high purpose for which God created us human beings, the Bible tells us he created us not only to manage the planet, discover him, and get ready for the new creation, but eventually to be able to rule over the angels and to teach and instruct them. So given the very high purpose which the Bible talks about and the tremendous complexity of human beings, that value and purpose, I think, is worth, from God's perspective, making a universe with 50 billion trillion stars and 100 times as much stuff as that, and carefully shaping and crafting it for 13.8 billion years. I mean, what I do and why the universe is the way it is kind of use the analogy of the marriage ceremony. And if you take the music out of the standard American marriage ceremony, it's basically about 20 minutes. But then you look at how much money we spend getting ready for a wedding day and how many man or woman hours are put into getting ready for that day. It's a huge investment for something that only lasts 20 minutes, but it's worth it because of the value and the purpose of that 20-minute ceremony. Likewise, I argue, and why the universe is the way it is, that all the expenditure on God's part, the billions of years of careful preparation, the 50 billion trillion stars and all the dark matter and dark energy, all of that's worth it given the very high value and the very high purpose that human beings have in God's sight. So it's not a waste. And it's just the first creation. There's a new creation that will follow. It will be even bigger and grander. And in that creation, we'll be gaining access to a limitless habitat space. But right now it's crucial we be constrained to one small planet, because after all, there's still evil around us, and that needs to be removed first.
I was thinking of a wedding analogy, actually, just before you started talking about it. I remember when I was dating Allie, I called an aunt once who owed me a bit of money and said, call me if you're in need. And I said, called her and said, I'd like to get that, all that money that you owe me now. Okay, how much? All of it. And she just said, you're buying an engagement ring, aren't you? Yes. Yes, I am.
Oh, good for you.
Yep, and it was certainly a worthwhile investment. And so what you'd be saying then, in many ways, is that the universe is the way it is because God's dealing with the problem of evil.
Yes, that what you see in the Bible is that God had evil and grace and redemption in mind before he created anything. So that was all there in his mind before he brought the universe into existence. And he literally created the universe with all the features that he needed to bring about a rapid, efficient removal of evil. To me, the amazing thing about the universe, yes, it's 13.8 billion years old, but look how rapidly God is eliminating evil and suffering in the context of human existence. We've only been here a few tens of thousands of years, and yet it's not going to be very much longer before evil and suffering are permanently gone, and we enter into a far more glorious creation. So to me, it's an amazing design that God can accomplish this very complex spiritual problem in such an incredibly brief period of time. But it's thanks largely to the physics and the structure of the universe that that's all possible.
I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking from a theological, historical perspective, which is the perspective I'm familiar with, that when Adam and Eve fall in the garden, that's not the case that, oh, where here comes Jesus right now, he's going to handle all the problems. Instead, you have the flood comes a few thousand years or so later, and then Abraham comes, and then maybe about 2,000 years after Abraham, finally, here shows Jesus on the scene, and all that time was spent preparing humanity for Jesus, that God didn't just deal with a problem immediately. He allowed things to prepare. And I think you're using the same kind of terminology with the universe, aren't you?
Well, yes, I am. In one sense, God is maturing the human species. I mean, another good analogy there is how we raise children. And we're preparing them for future challenges. And so we step-by-step expose them to greater and greater challenge. And this is what God was doing with humanity. It's what he is still doing with humanity. And it's all because he's preparing us for a very challenging career in a new creation. And so, yes, this life here on Earth does have some suffering and turmoil in it, but all that is getting us ready for a much greater blessing and a very challenging work job in the new creation. You know, I've been both a professor and a student, and what I recognize is that when I'm in the role of being a professor, my job is to make my students suffer so that through that suffering they'll be prepared to take on a very challenging and rewarding career. And really, a kind professor is one who measures out exactly the right amount of suffering, not too much so that you discourage your students, but not too little so that you don't adequately prepare them. And of course, we human beings are all different. Each of us gets exposed to a different degree of a discipline and a training. But all of us are being prepared for unique careers in a new creation.
So what would your advice then be to each of us in light of your book on how each of us can help bring about our preparation for the new creation?
Well, I would make the point that we are each different. We each have a different job to do here on Earth and a different job to do in the new creation. And it's basically discovering what's different about you relative to the rest of humanity. We're each unique. I mean, there's not another human being that's like you, for example. You are special. You're unique. You've got weaknesses. You've got strengths. And often I've found it's through investigating your weaknesses and disabilities that you can discover what it is that God really wants you to do. And recognize that we must not be envious of other people's roles. Find out how God made you special, what makes you different, and what makes you specially gifted to be a partner with God to bring about the full number of people who enter into the new creation.
And we'll certainly be talking about weaknesses and disabilities later on, Michelle. But for now, let's talk a little bit also, since we've talked so much about suffering and evil, about the book Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. Now, when I started reading this book and was going through the introduction, I started thinking, I think the first thing Dr. Ross probably learned from this book is, don't write a book about Job.
Yes. In fact, I was warned not to write a book about Job because I had been told that everybody who's done a commentary on Job wound up going through some extraordinary suffering, because after all, the theme of the book is how God ministers to you in suffering. And I kind of brushed that off and said, look, this book is not a commentary. What I'm doing is writing about the science that's in Job. And the reason why I was motivated to do that, I've read over several hundred commentaries on Job, and it's like they all miss the science. And there's no book in the Bible that's got more science in it than the book of Job. So my intent was just to focus on those science chapters, which is, you know, off about a third of the book of Job. But I also realized that the science in Job is integrated with the main theme of how God is using suffering to bring about the end of all evil. And therefore, I got to experience some suffering during the years I was writing that book, and that really helped me to integrate the message of Job in terms of how its science ties in to the problem of evil and how God is going to eliminate evil. And I particularly began to appreciate the role that animals play in the whole human endeavor, and I got a whole new appreciation for animals I didn't have until I started writing that book. And actually, probably a good 40% of the book is on the subject of what I call the second origin of life. In Genesis 1, it speaks about three separate origins of life. Creation Day 1, the origin of physical life. Creation Day 5, the origin of life that's physical and soulish. And then last of all, the end of Day 6, the one and only species, that's body, soul, and spirit, namely as human beings. But I recognize no one in Christianity has really done a serious work on the second origin of life, God creating the birds and the mammals, and how they fit into God's whole creation plan. So that's mainly what the book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, is all about, focusing on those soulish animals that are spoken of on Creation Day 5 in Genesis 1.
I married an animal lover, so I was very pleased to go through that, and I did share Barry some parts when I was going through me. I didn't read them, true, but I started saying, yeah, here's what Dr. Ross says about ostriches and horses, for instance. So when we're talking about animals, why don't we just get to the start and ask, why did God create animals then to begin with?
Well, he created the first origin of life. These would be the creatures that are strictly physical. And they basically get planet Earth ready for the second origin of life, which is talking about the advanced animals. But advanced animals require a planet that's chemically very different than what we see on Creation Day 1. And so it was unicellular life forms and the Cambrian explosion animals and the plants that predated the creation of birds and mammals that really chemically prepared the planet. I mean, for example, these higher animals need a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere. And I write in the book that there are about 22 elements in the periodic table that we identify as vital poisons. For example, chromium, if it exists at too high of a level in your diet, it will kill you. If it exists at too low of a level in your diet, it will also kill you. It has to be at a just right level. And it was this first origin of life that got all these vital poison elements at the just right levels so that advanced life can flourish. But then in Creation Day 5, God creates the sea mammals, the birds, he creates the land mammals. Creation Day 6, he talks about three specialized kinds of land mammals. And when you get in the book of Job, is how important these animals were in assisting human beings in launching civilization. And, you know, in the 21st century, we got this hubris where we think we got this high technology civilization all by ourselves. But the truth is, if God hadn't created these very carefully designed animals, the higher animals, we would have been stuck in the Stone Age permanently. It was thanks to the donkey, the horse, the cow, the goat, and the birds that are mentioned there in Job 38 and 39 that we were able to get ourselves out of the Stone Age and develop high technology civilization. And good evidence for that is there were three continents that had these animals, but when humans came in, they virtually killed all of them off. And those are the continents where humans were not able to launch civilization until Europeans and Asians came with the animals they needed to get out of the Stone Age. So that's the evidence we have today that, yes, these animals really were critical. But the other thing you see in the book of Job is that these animals are teaching lessons. What you see in chapter 12, Job speaks to his three friends and says, look to the birds, they'll instruct you. Look to the beasts of the field, they will teach you. And what you see later on in the book is they will teach you about yourselves, about God, and how you can come into relationship with God. And that's one thing I've noticed as the president of Reasons to Believe, is when I travel around the world, the atheists I encounter are predominantly from cities. You know, when I was speaking throughout rural Africa, I never met an atheist. It's because they were so surrounded by these animals that are mentioned in the book of Job, and Africa has got the greatest diversity of these animals, that they all said there's got to be a God.
Well, there are some people who say, and I'm not sure if this is accurate, you can tell me if it is or not, that over 90% of the species that have ever lived on this earth have gone extinct. So if that's the case, then does that place a lesser value on animals or what?
It does not. In fact, you see this in Psalm 104, that it's the property of all life to die off, but God recreates and renews the face of the earth. And it's something I talked about in another book, More Than a Theory, that if you look at the physics of the solar system, we have dramatically changing conditions throughout the history of life on planet Earth. The sun is getting brighter and brighter. The radiation environment in the crust of the Earth changes by a factor of 5. The rotation rate of the planet has slowed by more than a factor of six. So if you take into account those and other changes in the physics of the solar system, you recognize you need different life at different times. And so what God does is he creates life with an optimal ecological relationship, allows that life to exist on planet until the conditions change that are no longer favorable for those creatures. He removes those creatures and replaces them in a whole new set. And this is what we see in the fossil record. You see these mass extinction events almost immediately followed by mass speciation events. But every time you see a mass speciation event, the species show up immediately with optimal ecological relationships, which means it's not natural process evolution. What you see is the hand of a planner, someone who knows what the physics of the solar system is like and creates the best possible creatures to thrive and ecologically relate to one another with that new environment. And this is all leading up to preparing things for human beings, because what each successive generation of these life forms on planet Earth does over the past 3.8 billion years is salt the Earth with the biodeposits that will be crucial to help human beings launch and sustain global high-technology civilization. So, for example, if you look in the crust of the Earth, we see a minimum of 76 quadrillion tons of biodeposits. And it takes all those generations, extinctions and speciation events, to build up that huge treasure chest of diverse biodeposits that allows us today to launch and sustain our civilization.
I've noticed that after getting married, one of the first titles a husband usually gets from a house is official bug killer. And so that's making me wonder about how you talk about how these purely physical creatures serve to get way for the physical and soulish creatures. But yet you've also said that some species will die off when they're no longer needed. So does that mean that these creatures that are purely physical, these bugs and such, they're still playing a necessary role here in creation?
Yes, they are. I mean, that's another theme I take up in More Than a Theory, is how we need the detrivores. That's a reference to creatures that feed on decaying biological material and recycle the resources from the decaying material so that life forms can take up those nutrients and thrive. You need parasites. You need carnivores. You need herbivores. All that must be in a delicate ecological balance so that you can retain on the Earth a maximum biomass and biodiversity. Again, it's all in the context of God wanting to build up this huge treasure chest of biodeposits. And to make that work, you need this complex interaction between the herbivores, the carnivores, the parasites, and the detrivores. And notice that the balance is always in place throughout the fossil record, where not one group gets the advantage over the other. So, for example, you look at predator-prey relationships, it's such that the predators are only able to kill those the herbivores that are sick, that are weak, that are wounded, that are infirmed in such way. And what that does is it actually increases the population, the health, the well-being, and the longevity of the herbivore individuals and the herbivore herds as a whole. And so we may look at carnivores as something that's bad or parasites as something that's bad, but actually it's all at an optimal level so that all species of life have an optimal existence on the face of the earth. And just looking at that as a human being should teach us something about what God is doing with us.
And what should it teach us?
Well, the fact that God cares so carefully for things like ants and flies and mosquitoes and fish, how much more must he care for us human beings? And if he's actually salted the earth with all these biodeposits, how does he expect us to use those biodeposits? So it really kind of motivates us to discover, what is the purpose of humanity? And what is my individual purpose as a member of humanity in bringing about what God intends through his creation of Adam and Eve and their offspring?
Well, we're going to take another break right quick. I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Dr. Hugh Ross of Reasons to Believe. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
And we're back with Hugh Ross, president and founder of Reasons to Believe. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. Now let's talk about some interesting animals that show up in Job that are always a topic of conversation, and that's that where we know from many people that Job has to refer to some dinosaurs. And there are two creatures, the behemoth and the leviathan, and those just have to be dinosaurs, right?
Well, it's only in the last 150 years that Christians reading the Bible have concluded that the behemoth and leviathan are dinosaurs. If you read the older commentaries, you get a unanimous analysis that it's referring to the hippopotamus and the Nile crocodile. And what you notice in Job 38, all the way to the end of the book of Job, the theme is on the second origin of life, the nephesh animals, the soulish animals, the animals that we human beings contain to do our bidding. And so given that that's the larger context, then when you run into Job 40 and 41, the behemoth and leviathan must be members of that soulish, the nephesh creatures. And the dinosaurs are not in that category. They are physical animals, but they're not soulish animals. And so in that sense, it can't be dinosaurs. And really the larger message you're seeing in Job 38 to Job 42 is God is saying, look at all these animals I created for you. Look at how carefully I've designed them to serve and please you and to help you to launch civilization. And notice that some are easy to tame. So in Job 39, for example, it mentions a goat. And the goat was the first animal that we human beings domesticated. Very easy to tame a wild goat. And then he says, but there's other animals that are more difficult to tame. Talks about the cow. An adult wild cow is very difficult to tame. But when you do tame it, it really enjoys doing heavy farm labor for you. And what you see in the book of Job is how a cow has been designed to be extraordinarily strong. And for example, a cow has a neck that's so strong that its neck muscles are able to lift 9,000 pounds. And so it talks about this extraordinary design, but then makes the point that there's some animals that are even more difficult to tame than a lion, even more difficult to tame than a wild cow. And it mentions the leviathan and the behemoth. And centuries ago, when people had intimate contact with the animals that are mentioned in Job 38 and 39, they immediately recognized the behemoth must be the hippopotamus. It's extraordinarily difficult to tame. You will not tame a hippopotamus unless you raise it from the time that it was born. The only examples I know is where the mother died in childbirth and humans took the baby hippo and basically spent time with it every day. And when it reaches an adult, it will be tamed and will do your bidding. And then the most difficult one of all is the crocodile. Now, the crocodile is not a bird or mammal, but you see in the Levitical law is that a few of the higher reptilian species are classified as soulish animals. Why? Because they care for their young. That's something we see about crocodiles. They will take action, the mother crocodiles, to protect the crocodiles that were hatched from their eggs. And it is possible to tame a crocodile to do your bidding. And you can have an emotional relationship with a crocodile. But what you see in the biblical text, it is the most difficult of all the soulish animals to tame. And I know people who've tamed them, and literally you have to take the baby crocodile from the time it comes out of its egg and be committed to spend at least an hour with that crocodile every day throughout the entire life of the crocodile. Then it will do your bidding. Otherwise, you're going to suffer injury. And what you see in Job 40 and 41 is how dangerous it is to have a close encounter with either the behemoth or the leviathan if it has not been tamed. But at the very end of the book of Job, God steps in and says, you've been able to tame all these animals. What I want you to notice, though, is it takes a higher species to tame these soulish animals. They don't tame one another. It takes you, a human being, to tame these creatures. But he says there's one species of life you cannot tame, one soulish creature you can't tame. And he says, that's your fellow human being. God steps in and says, only I can bring humility to a proud human heart. You can't do it. Only I can do it. And that's one of the powerful lessons these animals teach us. As it takes a higher being to tame these soulish animals, likewise it takes a higher being to tame us human beings. And if we don't come to God for the humility that we need, then we're going to be trapped in our pride, and therefore we're going to be a perpetrator of evil rather than a removal of evil.
One objection that can be raised, though, about the idea that this is talking about the hippopotamus, for instance, and it was one that I was curious about and I was very pleased to see that you handled, is that the hippopotamus, the creature, the behemoth, I should say, is said to have a tail that sways like a cedar. And if you look at a hippopotamus's tail, it's really not that impressive. So how can it be said to have a tail that sways like a cedar?
Yeah, I mean, it's barely bigger than a pencil. So, however, if you go into hippo territory, and the reason why hippos are so dangerous, they like to kind of bathe themselves in muddy water. And, you know, hippos are very sensitive to sunstroke. So they'll during the daytime, they'll go into these muddy waters, and they'll sink, and all you see is a couple of nostrils. But if you get close to their territory, they'll often do a rapid wiggling of that tiny tail, which basically tells you, don't come any closer. And if you do, I'm going to get upset. But the word for tail in the Hebrew, with reference to the behemoth, is the word zanab. And it refers to the tail, but it also includes the rump, and particularly the rump muscles that are at the region where the tail is. And this is where the hippo is very well endowed. It's got extremely powerful rump muscles. And also, that's what Job speaks about, that when you come into the waters where hippos are residing, they will capsize your boat. And the way they do it is they use their powerful rump muscles in a swinging motion to flip your boat over. And, you know, the crocodiles know that the hippopotami are very territorial, and so they like to hang around hippos because they know that if some hapless animal or a boat full of human beings comes into the territory of hippos, the hippo is going to use its tail, including its rump muscles, to take care of whoever comes into its territory, and the crocodiles rush in and get a quick lunch. And, you know, I've been to Africa several times, and, yeah, wherever you got hippos, you've got crocodiles, because the hippos know about that rump action of the hippo.
One thing you also point out is that we don't have any evidence that these dinosaurs ever were in the areas talked about in Job, but we do have evidence the hippo was there.
That's true. I mean, hippos once resided in a much broader territory than they do today. So, for example, they were throughout the Middle East. The crocodiles were as well. But because of human predation, they now are limited to the continent of Africa. You know, people reading the Bible in ancient times were very familiar with these creatures. And also you need to recognize the descriptions in Job 40 and 41. You see, I've counted 21 times it uses the word like and as. So it's actually giving you a metaphorical picture. And the picture is this, how you as a human being would feel emotionally when you have a close encounter with a behemoth or a leviathan. So, for example, no animal and no dinosaur breathe fire and smoke out of its mouth. But what you see there in Job 40 is that 41 is that the leviathan breathes fire and smoke out of its mouth. Well, the picture is this. If you're, say, 10 feet away from a 22-foot-long crocodile, it may as well be breathing fire and smoke out of its mouth for all the good a stick is going to do to defend yourself against the creature. Or when it says it has plates of steel on its belly, it may as well have plates of steel on its belly for all the good a rock is going to do to defend yourself against this creature. And so just appreciating the metaphorical language is used there and what it's trying to communicate, then looking at the non-metaphorical language, whenever you see the non-metaphorical language, it's very accurate in describing the biological morphology of these creatures. So, for example, the Leviathan, it talks about how it's got kind of two sets of shields that run down its back. Well, if you look at a crocodile, it actually has that. You can see these structures that run down its back. The text also tells us that when it's moving over the mud, its tail leaves a swishing track in the mud, and indeed that's what crocodiles do. And likewise, you look at the description of the behemoth, tells us it's a herbivore. The hippopotamus is not going to eat you. It eats vegetables, and that's what the text says, but also describes how the creature likes to submerge itself in water and how difficult it is to see until you get too close.
Well, since we've talked about some animals that can be tamed, let's try to make this personal for me and my listeners in a way they can understand, because not many of us do live on farms anymore, but a lot of us, including myself and my wife, are pet owners. We happen to have a cat, for instance, here. So what benefit do we get from having pets?
Well, what you see in Genesis 1 is that God created these higher animals, some to serve and some to please. And that theme is brought up much more broadly and definitively in the book of Job. And so, for example, we can look at creatures like the goat, the horse, the donkey, the cow, and we can see how they've been designed to serve us and allow us to launch agricultural industry. But then there are other animals that really don't serve any benefit for agriculture, like the lion, for example. You really don't look at the lion as a farm animal. However, these carnivorous higher animals are designed by God to be able to have very strong emotional bonds with human beings. And so it's typically the carnivores that we bring into our homes as pets, because unlike, say, goats and cows, we can have a really strong emotional relationship with these creatures. And also they're so motivated to please us that we can train them to do amazing things. And so the herbivores, we use them on the farms, and the carnivores we bring into our homes as pets or as personal companions. And you notice that Job 39 speaks about the lion, a fierce creature, but when tamed by a human being, becomes an incredibly loyal and very pleasing companion. Although I'm not recommending that people go out and get a pet lion. In fact, where I live, it's illegal to have a pet lion. And that's because they're big, they're wild, they're difficult to tame, and if not properly cared for, they will be a problem. But that's even true for dogs and cats. If you don't properly take care of them, they're going to get themselves into a lot of trouble. And that's another point, too, is that these carnivorous creatures tend to be very intelligent. So a lion is much more intelligent than a cow, for example. But also that means that when you make a pet out of them, they're easily bored. And if you don't entertain them appropriately and give them things to do, then they will get into trouble. But notice how much we human beings enjoy the relationships that we have with these carnivorous creatures, both birds and mammals.
Yeah, well, part of me was when you were talking about how these animals are designed either to serve or please. Being a cat owner, I was thinking, I don't know. I think my cat thinks he's designed to be served.
Well, that's true. Cats are special. They love being served. But, you know, I've had cats, and I had a cat that every night would give me a back rub and seemed to know exactly where I had the tight muscles and was very good at it. And so they can do amazing things if you're prepared to train them. In fact, that cat would even go on walks with me, which is unusual for a cat. So it all depends to how much you're willing to invest in the creature, what it can do for you. But it is amazing the degree of pleasure we can get from the relationships we have with these creatures, In fact, I know people that sometimes seem to care more for their pets than they do their own children.
And very, all our theological lessons, I think we can learn. There have been many a conversation around here because we rescued our cat, and sometimes he still gets scared of many things. And I would say, "Why are you so scared of me?" sometimes, and I say, "Honey, many times are we really much better in that we're scared of ones who want to just love and adore us, namely God, that we can ignore him the same way?"
Well, that's something you see in the book of Job, is that God designed these birds and mammals to relate to us. And, I describe in the book my ventures in the going parts of Canada where humans haven't been in many decades, and how when you do that, you see how powerfully motivated these animals are to reach out to us human beings and to form relationships with us. But typically you don't see that. Rather, what you see is that the animals are afraid of us and run away from us. And it's because of our sin and our abuse. And so it's our sin that causes these animals to run away from us instead of towards us. Well, likewise, it's our sin that causes us to run away from God, or to pretend that he doesn't exist, rather than to seek him out. But if we can take care of the sin within us through God's help, then we see the opposite, where we have this desire to reach out to God and run to him instead of away from him. And I think that's part of the reason why people who have intimate contact with these animals, both the tame ones and the wild ones, that they recognize, yes, we human beings do have a motivation to seek after God. And if we do that, we can have a relationship with him. And that's part of the reason why I think that atheists are so much more frequently found in cities than they are in the countryside.
Yeah, I can attest to that, because I live out in the country area, and we don't know many atheists out here, which sometimes to me can kind of be disappointing, because every time I meet someone out in public, they're usually a Christian just like I am. Now, what would be the main lesson you'd want us to get from Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job?
Well, the fact, what you see in the Book of Job repeatedly is Job saying, the more you study nature, the more you'll see the handiwork of God. So I kind of look at that as a larger theme of the book. The more you look, the more you'll find. I mean, if you go to Matthew 6, Jesus says, seek and you will find. And that's kind of the theme of Job. And that's something I've seen with scientists. The more you look for the handiwork of God in your science, the more evidence you're going to find for the handiwork of God. That's the theme you see in all of the books that we publish at Reasons to Believe. The more you search, the more evidence you find. We were talking about extrasolar planets earlier. Now that we've found almost 2,000 of them, we have way more evidence than we had before that the planets that we see in our solar system were designed by God for the express benefit of human beings. That, too, is something Job is speaking about, that God has designed this whole universe, this planet, and all of its life for the express benefit of human beings. And if he did that, then we must be very valuable in his sight and have a very high purpose, and therefore we should be motivated to discover what that value and purpose is and how we can serve God to our full potential. But a lot of it has to do with dealing with the sin issue. And to me, the oldest book in the Bible, I believe Job is the oldest book of the Bible, clearly shows you the plan of salvation, how you can come into a fulfilling relationship with the creator of the universe, and how that plan is evident through the record of nature. So look to the beasts, look to the birds, you'll discover God's plan for having a relationship with you, and that way these animals can really teach you how you can come to God. And that's how I kind of close off the book. I call it the Gospel According to Creation. Not that Job knew the name of the creator of the universe, but he got all the crucial elements for developing a relationship with God just through looking at the creatures he saw on the earth with him. And that's why he could say in the 19th chapter, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that I will see him on the last day. In my flesh I will see him. And the amazing thing is, without the Bible, Job was able to declare his salvation and the assurance of his salvation, drawing from the evidence he saw in nature. And that's probably why Job is ranked as one of the three most righteous men of the Old Testament era, because of how humbly he was able to look at the record of nature and discern God's plan of salvation from what he was studying.
All right, well, the books are available on Amazon. You can get them on Kindle for $10 a piece. Why the Universe is the Way It Is, it's $13.98 for the paperback. And for the Hidden Treasures of the Book of Job, I see $12.01 listed for paperback. We got a call right here, but we're going to have to wait till we get back from our break. And when we get back, we're going to be going a bit personal. I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Rock Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite rock radio shows on your Apple or Android-powered devices. Best of all, it's absolutely free. So get it now in the Google Play or iTunes App Store, or grab a link at cyiworldwide.com.
And we're back, and right now I've got Hugh Ross with me, president and founder of Reasons to Believe. But if you're listening next week to the show, I'm going to have J. Wesley Richards with me, and he's the author of Money, Greed, and God. We're going to be talking about economics next week and its relation to apologetics, so you'll want to be here for that. Dr. Ross, we've got a caller here. Are you willing to take a caller now?
Oh, sure.
Okay, well, let's see how this turns out. Caller, you're on the air with Dr. Ross.
What's going on?
Hello?
What's
going on?
Do you
have a question? We're having a show.
Yo.
Do you have a question?
Glad to be on the show, guys. Mm-hmm. Long-time listener. Yo. First-time caller.
Okay. Do you have a question for Dr. Ross?
Sure. What's your favorite color?
What's my favorite color? Probably green, just because that's the color of life that we see on our planet, and I really enjoy the outdoors. And by the way, we live in a green galaxy, so one of the few green galaxies that exist.
Wow.
Yeah, we're going to move on at this point here. And, Dr. Ross, this month is Autism Awareness Month, and you're diagnosed as an ASPE, someone with Asperger's. How did this diagnosis come about?
Well, I didn't really realize that until a few years ago, and a couple that we're friends with, the wife is a psychologist, and she kept noticing that whenever I was talking to her husband, I would bump into him. And she says, that's a symptom of being on the autistic spectrum. And says, have you ever taken any tests for Asperger's syndrome? I says, no, I haven't. So she challenged me to do that. There's a whole bunch on the web. And there's one that's quite well known where you basically are asked 50 questions. And if your answer is yes for 24 of them, then you're an ASPE. Well, I got 48 out of 50, so I'm way up on the spectrum. And then she began to ask me questions. What was your childhood like? I said, well, I didn't talk until I was 7, and I couldn't hold a pencil. And, you know, I had real problems with athletics when I was in elementary school all the way up into high school. She said, those are all symptoms of being on the autistic spectrum. And I said, well, how did you get into public speaking and be able to interact with people? I said, well, I realized I was socially backward at an early age and recognized at age 7, if I don't start talking, I'm not going to be able to pass school. So I began to, you know, force myself to talk. And at age 16, I began to do public speaking. Was pretty terrible at it and was very terrifying for me, but I kept at it. And eventually, over the course of a few decades, began to develop social skills that I could actually function in a church. And, you know, part of the reason why it took me so long is I went into astronomy, and astronomy has a very high percentage of Asperger's. So, for example, I remember being at Caltech having a conversation with a bunch of astronomers, and we all just stared at the floor talking to one another. And that's kind of what Asperger's people do. They won't look you in the eye. But I really have to give credit to my wife. When I met my wife, we dated for 3 years before getting married. We knew one another for 3 years. We dated one another for 1 year. But she was the one that really trained me. Look, if you want to have an impact on people with this message that God has given you, you got to be able to look them in the eye. You got to give them some personal affirmation. You got to nod your head once in a while. So over the years, she's trained me how to function with, you know, neurotypical people. But the problem with being at Caltech is I didn't have to because everybody was like me.
And I'm guessing that, unlike me, your wife is neurotypical, right?
She is. We're very different from one another. And so I've often been tempted just to lean on her social skills for my social inabilities, but she's been very good at challenging me to work on my social skills in spite of the handicaps that I have, and I'm very grateful for her doing that. But she also stands amazed at things that people that are Asperger's can do. And, you know, we were talking about animals earlier. One thing I've noticed with people that have Asperger's syndrome, they seem to have a special way with animals. So, for example, I run a mountain trail every morning here in California, and I actually make friends with the wild animals. Nobody else does, but I do. And I also notice that young children, I can be on an airplane and suddenly a 2-year-old will jump on my lap, total stranger, and it shocks the parents. But one of the things I've noticed is that people who are, you know, significantly up the autistic spectrum, we're just not able to deceive people. And so we kind of have an outwardly trusting nature, especially if we develop that. And I think people who are Asperger's, who are Christians, tend to be particularly trusting. My wife says I trust too much. I get fooled by people because I'm so willing to trust people. But the flip side is people are willing to trust me. Animals are willing to trust me. Little children are willing to trust me. And you know, I remember being in an airport once, and this frenzied mother came by with 4 kids. And I could tell she needed to go to the restroom and buy some food for her children. She immediately spotted me and says, "Here, take care of my children." Well, it's pretty unusual for a stranger with 4 little children to trust another stranger to take care of her kids. But later she told me, says, "I just knew I could trust you." And so I took care of her kids while she needed to take care of some personal things. So the whole point is, yes, there are some real handicaps by being on the autistic spectrum, but there also come some strengths. And actually it explains why I've been successful as the president of Reasons to Believe. And it's something my wife has helped me with as well, because I have this ability to integrate very complex material into a consistent message. And I used to think everybody could do that. And sometimes I get impatient with my students when they weren't able to see how things fit together and integrate. And it was thanks to my wife that said, look, normal people can't do that. It's people who, you know, have a high IQ, who are Asperger's, not all of them, of course, but some of them have this amazing ability to integrate very complex material. For example, Albert Einstein was Asperger's, but it was thanks to his Asperger's that he was able to develop the theory of general relativity. So there's some real strengths that come with it, and of course some serious weaknesses as well.
As you explained, when we use the term neurotypical, we mean people who aren't on the autism spectrum. But I was listening to what you were saying, and I was thinking that a few years ago when I lived in Charlotte, my pastor, shortly after I got married, wanted me to do a sermon on 1 Corinthians 13. And I'm sort of thinking, oh, good, give me an easy one there, okay? And so probably the Friday night before, I say, well, I'm going to get out a couple of commentaries I haven't looked through them. And so I get up commentaries, just look through, and say, okay. And I just read through the sections one time. And then I get up that Sunday. I speak for about 30, 45 minutes or so. No notes whatsoever. And afterwards, I had a speech therapist come up who was visiting and said, if I had had months to work that material, I could not have compiled it that well. And you did it without any notes whatsoever immediately. And people were still talking about that sermon weeks later. And when I hear these kinds of things, I get so amazed. And I just think, I don't know what I did. I just got up there and spoke. It's perfectly natural to me.
Yeah, well, I think, too, it's important to emphasize that everybody who's Asperger's is different from everybody else's Asperger's. And what's important is to be able to find out, you know, what your particular weaknesses are by being on the spectrum, but also what your unique strengths are. And that, I think, will really help you to be successful in life. And but I think it's crucial, too, to realize it's hard work to develop the necessary social skills so that your strengths can actually benefit people. And I know a lot of people on the Asperger spectrum who really struggle doing the hard work of being able to interact well with neurotypical people. So it is hard work, but it's worth it.
I can tell you that when I'm out with someone, I really do have to try and remember every now and then, look in the eyes, look in the eyes. And if you're talking about weaknesses, I think my wife would tell you, my number one weakness is probably, in this case, food. Not that I eat too much, because if anyone takes a look at me, and you've met me before, you can tell I'm definitely not a heavy-set guy. In fact, I'm highly underweight, but that the only things I will eat are things that I can eat with my hands, and I won't eat anything that's the slightest bit messy, really. And that if I'm in a situation and something's brought for me and I don't know what it is, I panic. I freeze up immediately. And my wife, fortunately, doesn't have that weakness. And she's very much able to cover for me and explain why things are the way they are. And yes, we're still working on things here at home because we have to build each other up. But it is an example of how it affects you. And people who aren't on the spectrum really don't understand how that affects those of us who are.
Yes, I can remember in the early years of my marriage, you know, my wife getting impatient that I couldn't, you know, learn from her teaching more rapidly, you know, and discovering that I was on the spectrum, you know, really says, okay, I am working on it, but it's going to take time. And, you know, having her as a partner and being her patience and my patience working together, that really helps. But I can tell you, we've been working on this now for 35 years, and I'm still got a long ways to go. In fact, when I'm in front of an audience, my tendency is to stare at one person in the audience to the exclusion of everybody else, or my eyes dart all over the audience. And my wife, even to this day, is saying, no, what you need to do is focus on one person for a few seconds, then look at some other person, and kind of do that with a whole audience. But the problem is that I think too much about doing that, I lose track of my message. And I notice when she speaks, she's able to do all that seamlessly. But I can't do that. And she can't believe that I have to actually think about where my eyes are. But that's what people who are on the Asperger spectrum have to do. And likewise, if I'm walking on a trail with somebody, I really can't carry on a conversation with that person and walk at the same time. If I try to do that, I'm going to stumble, I'm going to bump into them. And so I either stop and talk or I just don't talk because I got to really focus on where my body is going. And that can be disturbing to people that are neurotypical because they can talk and walk at the same time. They don't have to worry about their balance, but that's something I do. But I also know people who are Aspergers for whom that's not a problem. Again, every one of us is different.
In fact, you're speaking to one of those people. It's not a problem for me. And the old saying is, if you meet one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, and don't think that we're all the same.
That's right. We're all different. But I think that applies to neurotypical people, too. Everybody is different. And what I say to people who are neurotypical, you've got weaknesses, too. And you've got strengths, and they're different from mine. And we need to understand what our strengths and weaknesses are. In fact, that's one thing I've done as the president of Reasons to Believe, is we brought a group in just to basically work with all of our employees on helping them identify their strengths, their weaknesses, and their motivations. And we actually have them have a little card in each of their offices, so when you walk in, you know what kind of person you're dealing with. You know, we tend to think that that's all automatic, but it isn't. So I think some of the tools that we're learning in the Asperger's community can actually have some benefit with people who are neurotypical.
Since you and I are both married, I'm sure that I've got several friends on the spectrum who are listening and who even like me, they think, you're so socially inept in many ways, and it's difficult to socialize. It's even more difficult to socialize with the opposite sex. I mean, people who are neurotypical can get scared silly to talk with a girl or ask a girl out, for instance, or vice versa. So they'd ask me, how is it that you got married? So I can ask you the same question. How is it that you came to get married if socializing is so difficult?
Well, that's probably the most common question I get when I meet people who are Aspergers is, please, can you give me some dating advice? That's probably the most frustrating thing about being Aspergers is your difficulty in trying to relate to the opposite sex. And it was very difficult for me. And in terms of my wife, I kept trying to get her attention and getting nowhere. I later found out she was trying to get my attention and getting nowhere. We were just responding in different ways, and eventually I had to write her a letter. And because, you know, I have difficulty with audio communication, but I'm good with stuff that's in print. So I had to write her a letter, and she wisely chose to write a letter back to me, and that's kind of how we got our relationship started. But to this day, we realize if we hadn't written those letters, we would have never gotten started. And the whole point there is, hey, in terms of your relationships, if something isn't working, try something else. And I can tell you this, it took me a six-month period trying to get the attention of my future wife, and I just kept trying different things. Nothing was working, and finally I found something that worked. And she was convinced I wasn't interested in her. I was convinced she wasn't interested in me, but it turned out to be quite the opposite. So just keep trying different things. If something doesn't work, try something else. I guess it helps that I'm an experimental scientist. So if one experiment doesn't work, I try something else. And I think that's got some application in personal relationships as well.
And I can tell people that, for my part, that I met Allie through a mutual friend who told me about her. And since she lived in another town, that started with emails. So I suppose that we did, for our day, essentially what you did back when you got married, because I don't think emails were probably as prominent back then, and I can definitely say if it probably hadn't been for a mutual friend, we probably wouldn't have been able to get things off the ground, as where I'm probably communicating at a great distance for the start of our relationship was a big help, since face-to-face communication can be so very difficult.
It can, and I think I had the advantage of being a Caltech astrophysicist. Is like, hey, if you're a Caltech scientist, people already know you're strange. And so they didn't treat me as a normal individual. And so I think that helped in my personal relationships. I mean, even before I was dating Kathy, I was on the pastoral staff of Sierra Madre Congregational Church. And but once people found out I was a Caltech scientist, they kind of gave me a lot of room. So I was able to get away with things that otherwise I would not have been able to pull off.
Well, we're going to go ahead and take another break right now. I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. We're talking with President and Founder of Reasons to Believe, Dr. Hugh Ross, and right now we are talking about Asperger's and autism. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcasts, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at CYIWorldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
I'd like to remind my audience that this show is, in fact, listener-supported, so please make a donation to Blog Talk Radio. And individually, everything that I do here is listener-supported. I don't get paid for doing the show, and I'm not able to pay my guests. Dr. Ross, for instance, is coming on with his own free time entirely. So if you'd like to support what we do here, I would really appreciate it. And the best way is to go to deeperwaters.wordpress.com, which is my blog, and to go and click on the donate section there to help support Deeper Waters. And you can make a donation to us. I can go through Ratio Christi, which means it will be tax deductible. Now, Dr. Ross, if someone wants to support what you're doing with Reasons to Believe, how can they do that?
Well, we also have a nonprofit. It's Reasons to Believe, and our website is reasons.org. And yeah, the bread and butter of what supports our organization are small gifts from private individuals. We don't get foundation grants. And so then, you know, people buy our books and DVDs, so we get a little bit of support from that, and also some from the courses that we teach. We offer a variety of courses at graduate, undergraduate, and a high school level. But the bread and butter are people making small gifts to our organization. So those are definitely appreciated. And reasons.org is a repository of literally tens of thousands of articles and podcasts that people can read or listen to, and video clips that they can watch, including a number of debates.
I like to open up the lines here for questions, talking about autism and Asperger's. And if you know someone on the spectrum and you'd like to ask a question, or if you're on the spectrum yourself, the number is 714-242-5180. If you don't feel comfortable calling in, you can email me. If I get your email before the show goes off, I'll see what I can do if asking a question. And my email is aplogiainick@gmail.com. So we'd really like to be able to connect with you if you're on the spectrum or know someone on the spectrum, and let them know how they can relate, how they can make it in the world. Dr. Ross, I've heard you say that you'd find it easier to speak to 100 people than to one person. Is that accurate?
Oh, that's very accurate, and I think that's typical of people who are on the spectrum. Because when you're talking to one or two people, people expect you to be able to read body language and emotional signals. But if I'm in front of an audience of 1,000 people, nobody expects me to read their body language. And so that's a much safer environment for me than it is talking to people one-on-one afterwards. Although I do tell you, I enjoy talking to people one-on-one, but it's largely thanks to the training I've received from my wife that I'm able to function in that capacity. But I think that's important is that I've noticed with people who have Asperger's, they really crave that one-on-one interaction. It's just that they're so clumsy with trying to relate to people one-on-one. And I think it's just a matter of being honest. And so I often will tell people that, you know, I'm on the spectrum so that, hey, you know, if you're giving me an emotional signal, I'm probably not going to pick up on it. And it's also helped me when I'm doing these debates with people who are very vitriolic towards me, because I don't realize I've been offended or insulted by somebody until about 2 or 3 hours later. And by that time, the debate is over. But also people get the idea that I can't be emotionally hurt because, you know, I will not respond to emotional hurt. And that's really not true. I really do feel the emotional pain. It's just that it's delayed by 2, 3, or 4 hours. And so I think that's a big barrier for people who are Asperger's trying to relate to neurotypical. The neurotypicals think we don't have emotions or we can't be hurt. Or we don't enjoy anything. No, the real issue is that our emotions are delayed. But I tell you, it's a big advantage when I'm debating people who are very nasty, because I will not respond to the nastiness. The reason why I don't even realize that it's there.
Yeah, I just had someone email me a question, and I think you answered it partly already. with letter-writing work, but he said, Dr. Ross said he tried different things or dating approaches. If it's not too personal to ask, what approaches did he try and which one finally worked? And you've said letter-writing worked, but what didn't work?
Well, what didn't work is trying to signal my interest in the woman who became my future wife. You know, I would try talking to her, and she just wasn't getting it. And so I realized, okay, that's not working. And I tried doing things for her. I figured, hey, you know, if I'm doing things for her, she's going to realize that I'm interested. But what she said later, hey, you help everybody. So I didn't really take that as any special interest in me. So, and then she, what I realized later is that she really wanted a relationship with me, but didn't want to be too forward. So she was working hard on not being too forward with me, because she says so many other women were being forward. But says what I finally realized is you don't even notice when women are being forward. In fact, to this day, she says the wonderful thing about being married to you, you don't even realize when another woman is flirting with you. I said, but the problem is I don't even realize when she's flirting with me. You know, so there are the benefits, but there's also the disadvantages there. So, but again, my advice would be, hey, if something's not working, try something else. And if you're being offensive, people will usually tell you. And so often I'll ask people, and I do this when I'm talking to non-Christian skeptics, I'll often ask them, you know, is there a better way we could approach this conversation? And, you know, is there some way that I've offended you here? And so I found that if you ask, people will tell you where you're really not being appropriate in your behavior or in the words that you're saying. In fact, I can tell you this, the reason why I didn't talk till I was 7 is I would make these blunt statements like, Mom, that lady's fat. And she would, rebuke me and say, you can't say that. So I eventually figured out it's best not to say anything at all because everything I said offended people. Well, I still struggle with that to this day. I got to be careful about my blurting out impressions about people because it may not be interpreted the way I want it to be interpreted. But if you ask, people will tell you.
I found it rather amusing about how your wife was trying to not be too forward because even today, there can still be times that I find out later on that Ari's been trying to romantically engage with me, and I've totally missed it. And she was like, well, I was trying to just now, and you missed it. And then I find out, and I'm kicking myself the rest of the day and say, like, how could I miss that? How could I miss that?
Well, even after being married for 36 years, I still struggle with that. So it's still an issue for us. But hey, the fact that we're so different also means that we're never bored with one another.
Yep.
But again, and it's hard. What my wife says is the thing about when people are Aspergers, they don't ask questions. They make statements. They don't ask questions.
Right.
And so I've really been working hard on trying to ask questions when I meet people rather than, quote, giving a mini lecture. I mean, that's the temptation for all of us who are Aspergers. We love to give mini lectures. And sometimes the mini lectures become long lectures. And my sons have really helped me with that.
Yeah, well, I usually try and tell people who don't understand what's like. And I've already denied him being Aspergers. I say, watch The Big Bang Theory and watch Sheldon Cooper. That's a pretty good idea of a way we usually are.
Well, if people ask me about that program and said, are Caltechers really like that? I said, well, actually, what you see on television is toned down. They really couldn't portray what it's really like, so they had to really tone down the nerdiness because actually we're much more nerdier than what you see there. I mean, I'll give you an example. We have a physicist on our staff, and he wears the same outfit every day to the office. And why does he do that? He doesn't want to think about his clothes. So he's got 7 pairs of khaki pants and 7 pairs of blue Oxford shirts. And he wears the same thing every day. And then one day for his birthday, we all decided we would wear khaki pants and blue Oxford shirts. So here's 30 of us wearing the Dave Rogstad outfit. All day long, he never even noticed. But that's kind of typical of people who are on the Asperger spectrum, that you just don't notice those things.
When you were talking about the one-on-one conversation also, I was thinking about when I was in Charlotte, I was told I could go to a conference of my church, but one of the first things I had to do was do some personal evangelism on the street, which to me, it was kind of like saying, hey, would you like to go skydiving? Yeah, except maybe that was a little bit safer. And they said that we could take someone else with me, and so I had someone go with me. Someone got the conversation started, and then I was able to jump in. And when it was done, I was like, phew, that's done, finally. Because on the spectrum, I can say, I would much rather talk to 100 people than to one. And if a conversation goes somewhere that I can handle, where I'm fine, then let's go. But to just go up and engage a stranger, suddenly it's a top 10 nightmare, pretty much.
Well, my story is a little bit different, because one of the first things I did when I joined our church staff is take people door-to-door evangelism. And, I was quite comfortable talking to a total stranger, although I realized when I would knock on somebody's door, I wouldn't look at them. I would just stare at their doormat. But the stuff I was sharing with them, they found so interesting that I was able to make headway. But for me, it was much easier to talk to a total stranger than to talk to somebody I knew or somebody I met at the church. And I can tell you this, however, it was very scary for me to do that. But I said, you know, the only way I'm going to get the people in our church doing this is if I do it. And they all know how terrified I was to do it. But the fact that I did it kind of told them, wow, this is priority. And so they kind of felt a little bit of pity on me to some extent, because they saw how difficult it was for me to do it. They said, well, you know, it's difficult for us too, but we're going to go. And the amazing thing was how many people came to Christ right on their doorsteps. I mean, literally every weekend we would lead people to Christ, and sometimes as many as a dozen or more people would come to Christ. And what I realized is, you know, there are a lot of people out there that want the truth and want a relationship with God. They just need somebody to tell them. And finally, I realized if I'm committed to talk to total strangers about the Christian faith, then God will supernaturally lead me to those people that are prepared. And I've especially seen that in all the airplane rides I take. You know, I find myself seated beside somebody, and they look at my computer and they start a conversation. And often it leads to them giving their life to Christ or wanting some of my books, and I hear from them later how it brought them to faith in Christ. So my whole point is it's scary. It's scary for everybody, neurotypical, Asperger's, whatever, but it's something God has commanded us to do. Always be ready to give an answer for the hope within you with gentleness, respect, and a pure conscience. I figured God wants me to do this. He's going to find a way to help me get the conversation started.
I'm also curious if you have a hard time with what's usually called small talk. Because I happen to live next door to my parents, and I can go up there, and they'll want to talk with me sometimes about, like, oh, how's your day been, and things like that. And to me, it's, this doesn't really compute, this doesn't really matter to me. Let's talk about some subject matter or something that's actually interesting. You know, usually when I meet people, I say, forget the small talk, cut to the chase, what's on your mind? Do you have a similar problem?
Oh, very much so, and I think that's kind of a common denominator for anybody with Asperger's, is they want to cut to the chase. But again, as my wife has taught me, is that the small talk is crucial, because what people do with small talk is they're kind of reading your body language, your emotional signals. And for people that are neurotypical, they need that first before they're willing to engage in something serious. Whereas those of us who are Asperger's, who are very clumsy with our body language and emotional communication, we'd rather just go straight to the good stuff and get something started. But with neurotypical people, that often comes across as offensive. If it's in your first encounter with them, you immediately get down to some serious subject. And they say, you know, who are you? Are you a professor or whatever? Because you seem to be able to jump to this stuff right away. So I've learned the hard way that we have to allow people to, quote, read us a little bit. And it's not pleasant, it's not comfortable, but it's crucial if you want to have successful relationships with people that are neurotypical. So, yeah, I agree with you. I hate the small talk, and I'm not able to communicate well with my body language, but I'm willing to give it a go just to see if I can get people comfortable enough that they're willing to engage in serious conversation. But there's always those people where all they want is small talk, or all they do is tell jokes, and we never get to the serious stuff. And frankly, for me, that's very frustrating. But I think part of it is they can't get an emotional read on me, and so all they can do is engage in small talk. So in many respects, it's my problem, not their problem.
Something also that we can struggle with on the spectrum is the idea of empathy, that it can be very difficult to see things from a perspective of the other, that you're usually caught in your own world entirely. Do you relate to that as well?
Well, I do, and you know, that's a common charge against people who are on the autistic spectrum, that they lack empathy. And it's not that they lack empathy, it's that they have a hard time expressing empathy, especially
right.
A hard time expressing empathy to adults.
Mm-hmm.
And I've found that when I'm struggling talking to neurotypical adults, it's much more important that I relate to the pets and the little children that are around, or the older people, because it's quite easy for me to show empathy at that level. Why? Because a two-year-old is not really expecting me to read their emotional language. And for that matter, a two-year-old is so obvious with their emotional language that even I can spot it. Likewise, animals are that way. I found that when I was doing door-to-door evangelism with strangers, I would make it a point to relate to their pets first before I tried to relate to them. Because what that did is it showed them that I do have empathy, but I may have a hard time expressing it to them as an adult. Or the other thing is that the empathy can be delayed. And that's a problem, say, in my relationship with my sons and my wife, is that, you know, they're struggling trying to get empathy out of me, and, you know, it's there, but it might take 3 hours to really come out in a way that they can recognize. And so, you know, often I get charged by saying, you know, you just don't care. Well, I try to tell them I do care, and I say, yeah, but all we're hearing is intellectual talk. We want to hear your heart. Well, I'm not able to express that, you know, right off the bat. It takes time, and I've got to think things through. And they say, you're thinking instead of feeling. Well, that's what we do. In order to feel, we have to think first.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can empathize with all that, right?
Oh, yes. And I can often think that many times if my wife's struggling with something, and I think this is something that all men struggle with, but I think it's even harder for those of us who are Aspies, that a lot of times she wants me to feel the problem with her and just be there and offer my comfort, but my intellectual side is saying, okay, let's examine this from a logical perspective, let's look at all the solutions, let's put out a plan here, see what we're going to do, and she's saying, I don't want that right now.
Right, right. Yeah, that's definitely the way it works. So I think it helps to watch a Star Trek episode and look at Dr. Spock. Because that's often how we Asperger's types come across.
It's only logical.
That's right. But the mistake is to think that we're only logical. We're not. We are emotional people. But
mm-hmm.
our emotions are just expressed in a very different way.
Well, we're going to take another break here, and we're back. We'll be wrapping things up with Dr. Hugh Ross. I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com. Home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
We should spend some time, well, since I'm here with Hugh Ross, away talking about Asperger's, talking about the life of the mind for someone on the autism spectrum. And it makes sense to me that you got an interest in astronomy, which not everyone on the spectrum, of course, gets that interest, but once you get the interest, you become fixated on it. What I've noticed on the spectrum is that we don't really usually develop a mild interest in anything. If we have an interest in anything, it is practically an obsession.
Yeah, that's true. And, people are amazed at how disciplined I can be in, doing the research and doing the writing. But that's kind of the way I am, and I actually enjoy it. I remember being on an airplane once, and I was reading this very thick astrophysical journal, and this lady was asking me questions and said, "Well, what do you read when you want to read something for fun?" And I said, "Well, this is what I read for fun. I have a hard time reading novels, but I love to read stuff that's, all about facts and how they all fit together and just have this incredible curiosity. I want to know how the universe fits together, how it works, how life on planet Earth works." And so it's no big deal for me to, literally hole up in a room all by myself for 8 hours and do nothing but read journals and take notes. And I notice normal people are amazed that I actually enjoy doing that. And then how disturbed I get when there's noise around me. If you go to our Reasons to Believe office, my office door is closed. I have no music on. I want it to be really quiet. I need that in order to be able to focus and concentrate.
I was listening to what you were saying. I can read some fiction every now and then, but as I thought back, most of the fiction that I read, even to this day, is mysteries. Like when the Monk mystery book series came out, I can get those. I think, yeah, so when I'm reading fiction, I'm still reading something intellectual.
That's right. Yeah, and my parents struggled with that when I was a little boy because they just said, all you want to do is read and study.
Mm-hmm.
And, they tried to get me doing other things, and that just frustrated me.
The only ever main interest I've had all my life is video games, which I think is also really common on the Asperger spectrum. We can really relate to those a lot. And that's probably the only way I've ever been able to socialize with many people is we can have that common interest. Go to their house, there's a game system. Okay, I'm set. We can socialize here. But when it comes to reading, when I first got into apologetics, my parents started panicking, so my mother mainly, not because they didn't like what I was doing, but because whenever I went out to the bookstore, I came home with bags of books, and it was just reading, reading, reading.
Yes, well, that happened to me when I was 7. I got instructions on how to go to the main library in Vancouver, and my parents were rather shocked that I came home with 5 textbooks on physics and astronomy. And then the next weekend, I came back with 5 more. And so that's when they said, "Oh, we got to get you outside. You got to play. You got to, have friends over." But really, all I wanted to do is read and study those books. But I do thank them for the fact that they literally forced me to begin to engage people in the neighborhood and do normal activities with them. That really did help me later on in life.
When it comes to that, for me, I definitely didn't have any trouble winning the summer reading competitions going on at the library, and I'd go to the library and I'd come home with just bags and bags of books that I was reading.
Yeah, well, in my case, I remember the librarian was concerned that all I was reading was books on physics and astronomy. She kept pushing biology books at me, and I'd read a few of them, but I always kept going back to the physics and astronomy stuff. And whenever she put fiction in front of me, nah, I wouldn't touch that at all. Although I was able to read history. So I remember reading all of Winston Churchill's works when I was in elementary school. And, so eventually the teachers figured out I was different and kind of, pushed me and basically left me alone. And that works. And many times that's what happens with somebody who's on the Asperger spectrum. They just want to be left alone at times. There are times when they want to socialize and times when they want to be left alone. I mean, I've found, for example, that computer programmers who are on the autistic spectrum are phenomenal in their ability to write code, but they can only write code if they got the door closed, no noise, and nobody bothering them. And so we had this amazing programmer when we were at Caltech, and we would basically just leave him alone for 12 hours or bring him food every 4 hours. So, and the whole point is don't worry about how much you're paying me, but I want the best computer money can buy.
I've found a remarkable similarity of that, because Allie, we like to go to bed much earlier than I do. I'm a night owl. I like to usually stay up to at least midnight, so if she wants to go to bed at 10 or 10:30, where I'm going to do other things then, so what I've found is I'll pray with her, because we pray every night, and she'll go to bed, and then I'll get up and I'll go to the living room, and I'll have my book with me, and I'll just be reading it pretty much the whole time there. And when it comes to bed then, I find I'm much more able to rest easier, because I know I've given my necessary time to study at that point.
Well, again, we're all different. I'm kind of the opposite. I'm a morning person, because I like to get up in the morning and run a mountain trail, get my blood pumping, and then I start doing my studies. But my wife loves to read into the early hours of the morning. So, hey, we're all different.
Yep.
We need to live with our differences and actually appreciate and enjoy our differences.
I'm kind of curious how it might work for your retainment of knowledge as well, because people are telling me that I kind of have an encyclopedic knowledge of what's going on in my field of apologetics. And I'll tell people, I can remember something I read in a book about 10 years or so ago. I can't remember what you told me in conversation 5 minutes ago.
Well, that's very true of me as well. I mean, I can remember not only what I read 20 years ago, but what page it's on and what part of the page that thing is on. I kind of get a picture in my mind. But what frustrates my wife is I'll get off the phone and she says, "Who called?" I says, "I don't know. I've forgotten. But I took care of it. Don't worry about it." And that's kind of the way I am with audio communication. If I've taken care of it, I immediately forget it. But my wife is dumbfounded that a conversation I had literally 30 seconds ago, I can't even remember. I can't remember the content. I can't remember the person. But also what surprised a lot of people that were supporting our ministry, I wouldn't know their names, but I knew their addresses. So, you know, certain things stick in my mind. Other things don't stick in my mind at all.
I had a friend who I met in Bible college, and he got me go to the seminary that I was attending for a while, and then I've gone my own way since then, but we've remained good friends, and he's known about my Asperger's. In fact, he does my fundraising for me, because he knows I hate calling people just cold calling and saying, "Hey, would you care to make a donation?" So he says, "I'll do that for you, okay?" And anyway, he had a strange situation where his son was diagnosed with Asperger's, and he contacted me and said, "What do you have to say? What's your advice at this point?" And the first thing I said, and he said, "This is the most helpful advice I got," was to him to say that, "Congratulations, you have been blessed with a gift. You are going to see the world with a whole new set of eyes that you've never seen it before. Take full advantage of this situation. You've been given a gift." Now, what would you say to a parent who's told you their child has been diagnosed with an autism disorder, and they're concerned about how their child's going to succeed in the future?
Well, I would tell them this is not a disease. It's not a disorder. Your child is different. Only about 1 in 100 in the population are on the spectrum. But those that are and those that are high-functioning, especially those with a high IQ, the human population needs them. They can do things normal people can't do. And so it took Bill Gates to launch Microsoft. He was on the spectrum. He was able to do things that normal people couldn't do. Likewise, it took someone on the autistic Asperger's spectrum to invent and launch the theory of general relativity. So we need these people. We don't need a lot of them, but the way God has set it up, we don't have a lot of them. You know, it's a relatively small proportion of the population. But these are the ones that make these amazing inventions and wind up launching new disciplines of human endeavor. And so they're very necessary and crucial. And what I'd say to parents is everyone on the spectrum is different from everybody else in the spectrum. You need to discover where your child has a gift, where they can do things nobody else can do, and encourage them in that gift. And they say, well, how do you do that? And I says, well, I found the best way to do that. And I think this is actually good advice, even if you've got normal children, is expose them to advanced material. And so I think it's a good idea, say, with your children, is expose them to college-level material. And one of the benefits of that is that books that are written at the college level tend to be written by people who understand their subject, have a passion for their subject, and they have to compete in the open market. So if they write a lousy book, they're not going to sell their books. And but what happens is you begin to discover, okay, my child just didn't read the parts in the book that are at their learning level. They're reading parts that are 8 grade years above their level. They have a special gift in that area, and I can channel them in that direction. Now, that may not be like a scientific discipline. It could be art. It could be music. I mean, I believe, for example, that Mozart was on the spectrum, and you know, his parents were able to discover that he had an unusual gift. He had huge handicaps, but he had an unusual gift, and they were able to, you know, encourage him to develop that gift. So it's not easy, but hey, if you develop that gift in your child, it can be really rewarding for your child as well as for you as parents, as you see them blossom and develop. My own parents said that about me, that once I found my niche, they were really excited about how I was flourishing in that niche.
I can definitely relate to that in many ways. When my sister was in high school, I would sometimes help her with math, except I was in first grade at the time. And to this day, I still get insulted if someone pulls a calculator out if I'm around. And I can think about so many ways that it's just, I really want to go with the most information that I can. And I've been working on teaching myself Greek a lot lately, and the vocabulary is just, it's not hard to memorize the vocabulary. And if we're talking about famous people who've been on the spectrum, I often think that Thomas Aquinas was on the spectrum based not just on his unique knowledge, but what I've read about his social interactions with people. He seemed rather clueless about them, but everything he said was quite clearly brilliant.
Yes, it was, and you know, there are people that have no problems of being fluent in 20 different languages. You know, that's not my gift, although it's easy for me to be fluent in a dozen different computer languages. You know, that's a little different, and I find it easier to communicate to a computer than to communicate to people. But the whole point is, if you're on the spectrum, there is going to be something special that you can do and that you can enjoy. I think that's also a good piece of advice, is that your child who's on the Asperger's spectrum, they're going to be able to enjoy things that normal people can't enjoy. And you may be dumbfounded that they're so excited about pursuing a particular endeavor. But hey, if they like it, encourage them to continue in that area. You may not like it, but they like it, they enjoy it, and they'll let them thrive.
Do you have any resources you'd recommend for people who or on the spectrum, or people who are raising children on the spectrum, or want to know someone on the spectrum that would help them out?
Well, I'm trying to think. There's an organization here in Southern California that's been very good in working with people on the spectrum. In fact, I'm trying to think. Yeah, the lady's name you can Google. Her name is Louise Ukleja, U-K-L-E-J-A. She founded an organization to help people on the spectrum. Another organization that's been doing a lot of work on this is the one founded by Johnny Erickson Tata. Her and her husband, Ken, told me that, you know, their ministry to the disabled is now predominantly towards those that are on the autistic spectrum. They said over half the letters they get are from people on the spectrum. And so they've actually restructured their organization of working with the disabled in that direction. But again, it's right in theme of what they said. You know, Johnny has told me, hey, when you're physically disabled, that can be a gift. And of course, a lot of her ministry and testimony is how her disability caused through an injury opened up things that otherwise would have never happened. So it's a principle that can be extended beyond just those of us that are on the Asperger's autistic spectrum.
Now that ministry would be Johnny and Friends, and we in fact work with them here in Knoxville, and they actually had a beauty pageant for people on the disability spectrum, no matter the disability, back in January here, the Miss Shining Star, and I was very, very pleased and honored to say that I was the man who took the first Miss Shining Star home that evening with me.
So very good.
We've got about 5 minutes left or so. Dr. Ross, if people are very interested in what you've said so far and they'd like to know more, they'd like to get in touch with you and such, how do people get in touch with your work?
Well, they can do that through visiting our website, reasons.org. We also have an 855 number, 855-REASONS. So that's easy to remember, 855-REASONS. And, you know, they can get a hold of our books and DVDs and podcasts. And as I mentioned earlier, we got literally thousands of articles on our website that people can read. A lot of the stuff we make available for free. So a lot of the debates I've done with atheists, you can see or watch on our website. And likewise with Christians that take different perspectives and how we deal with Christians who disagree with us. I think that's crucial, too, because often non-Christians want to see how we Christians treat one another before they trust us with how we're going to treat them. So reasons.org is the website. And, if you're looking at our books, the ones you mentioned today, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, and Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, those are good places to start. And for those who need more in-depth material, we've got over 20 other books that you can get through reasons.org. We also answer, every email question we get. So you'll see a feature on our website where you can send in a question. We either answer that through a podcast or we have literally dozens of our volunteers that we've trained to answer that mail. So if people have questions, they can reach us. If they want to know about the autism part, you can actually get, I think I can offer this to your listeners. If they will contact, Reasons to Believe, and mention that they were listening to the Deeper Waters program, we'll send them a free copy of my story of how science brought me to faith in Jesus Christ. And so it's about a 35 to 40 minute message that they can get from us free of charge. If they contact us and mention they heard us on Deeper Waters.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's the first time we've had a guest do something like that, and that's an incredible offer. And no, had nothing to do with that one, but we've got a little over 2 minutes left. What's the final message you would like to leave with my listening audience?
Well, a final message I would leave is 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give good reasons for the hope within you, but do it with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. It's crucial for those of us who are followers of Jesus Christ to be diligent in developing good reasons. And one way you do that is ask people where their questions and doubts are, and then prepare yourself to deal with those questions and doubts that they're expressing. And that's a lot of what we do at Reasons to Believe, is provide people with those sound reasons for the most common questions that people raise. But I think it's also important, your demeanor. It's crucial that we express these reasons with gentleness, respect, and a pure conscience. And that only happens through practice. The first few times you try sharing these your reasons for your hope, it may not come across well, but keep trying. People will tell you where you're being offensive, and then really help get other Christians to help you. But the whole point there is that people listen much more to your demeanor than your words. So if you can express those good reasons in Christian character, it will have an impact. And when you do that, God will supernaturally send people to you. Just like he did with Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, he will do that with you as well. But the first step is 1 Peter 3:15.
Well, Dr. Ross, it's been a pleasure having you on talking about these topics, and I appreciate you getting so personal as well, and I hope you've enjoyed yourself, and that we'll see you on here again sometime.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I've been very much appreciative of the ministry that you have. So thank you.
Thank you. And next week, we'll have J. Wesley Richards on to talk about money, greed, and God. For now, I'm Nick Peters, signing off.